Right, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here tonight. And I very much appreciate the warm, welcoming words of Rabbi Glatt. Tonight's topic is the prohibition of secular courts in Jewish law. I understand that in connection with my presentation this evening, the attorneys who are in the audience are eligible to receive a credit of CLE, continuing legal education credit, for the discussion. And in addition, that there is a plan to tape the comments tonight. So I will try to target my remarks towards the attorney audience in order to address issues that commonly are faced by practitioners in the field in connection with the topic. I cannot guarantee. I always like to give a little bit of a disclaimer before I begin that I will try to be 100% perfect in the accuracy of my quotations and my comments and my analysis. But for anyone who may be listening to this 50 years hence, for however long the tape recordings of the presentation may survive, I do not guarantee the correctness of everything that comes out of my mouth, and certainly I urge people to always analyze these issues on their own and use my own comments as a springboard for further research and analysis and conclusion. Having worked for a number of years as the director of the Benton of America, I had the distinct privilege, some might say the distinct community burden, of having to deal with hundreds, if not thousands, of different disputes. We had a caseload every single year at the Benton of America of probably something in the range of 600 cases that came across the Benton. Many of these cases were in the matrimonial arena. I would say that at the time that I left the Beis Din as director, I'm still an associate member of the Beis Din as a Chaver Beis Din. At the time that I left several months ago, we were receiving in excess of 100 commercial cases a year for adjudication and for resolution. And we also dealt with many, many cases for personal status issues where we had to clarify the personal status of different individuals. So I will focus on the arena of dispute adjudication and the specific role of the Beit Din and the specific role of the attorney dealing with issues relevant to the Beit Din, to the rabbinical court system this evening. Really, it all starts, as do most precepts of Jewish law, with certain biblical requirements. There is a negative prohibition that is derived from the Torah, and there's also a positive requirement that is derived from biblical verses. And that is, the negative prohibition states, in the beginning of Parshas Mishpatim in the Torah says that all of the precepts, Eilu Mishpatim Asher Tasim Lifneim, that are supposed to be presented before them, and the before them that is described or alluded to in the verse is a reference to judges, is a reference to the Beis Din system, to the rabbinical court system that is described both in Parshas Yisro, with the elaborate court system that was set up between Moshe Rabbeinu and his father-in-law Yisro, or through the counsel of his father-in-law Yisro, and the functionality of rabbinical courts described in Parshas Mishpatim. So from this verse is derived, as is described in source number 6, in the materials, the comments of Rashi on that particular verse. I'll try not to read too much inside, but just to make reference to the sources when relevant. But Rashi basically says that we derive a negative inference from the fact that the Bible, that the Torah says that you must present mishpatim, you must present monetary issues, lifneihem, before the Jewish law judges. We can infer from that statement that one is not allowed to present Jewish law issues, specifically in the realm of monetary law, for the adjudication of the non-Jewish courts. And the reason for this, explains the famous commentator Rashi, the reason for this is that our pride joy of our religion is that our religion addresses all of our needs, not only in the ritual sphere, but also in the monetary realm, and that it is a insult. It's an insult to God to suggest that the extensive legal system that he has presented to us is somehow insufficient to enable us to deal with our internal problems and our internal disputes. And therefore, since it is considered to be both an insult to the divine system of law that we have been given, and concomitantly, it is an improper embrace of a foreign system that could be based upon idolatrous notions, but even if not based upon idolatrous notions, is almost by definition idolatry to embrace a foreign system that is other than the divine law that was given to us by God. And for this reason, it is prohibited to present monetary disputes according to Jewish law between two Jews in front of a secular court, in front of a secular legal system. Now, this negative notion is counterbalanced, obviously, by the positive notion of Ve'elam Mishpatim Ashir Tasim Lifneim, that these are the ordinances that are supposed to be placed in front of them, namely the Jewish law judges, which is in line with the separate verse in the Torah, in Parsha Shoftim, that says, Shoftim Mishotrim Titen Lecha B'chol She'arecha, that in all of your gates and all of your sojournings, you are obligated to establish judges and Shoftim, judges and Shotrim, enforcers of the law. That there is a positive obligation, a positive mitzvah, to establish a Beis Din, to establish a rabbinical court system with the rabbinical court judges. I always would supplement that thought with an additional Gemara that appears in Sanhedrin that comments on the famous verse of Tzedek Tzedek Tirdof, where the verse says that righteousness, righteousness, you shall pursue it. And the Gemara asks, why do you have to say the word righteousness twice? Why can't you just say the word righteousness once? So the Gemara answers, it's not sufficient just to fulfill this obligation from a Jewish ethical perspective. I think you're supposed to get an ethics credit, so I have to get the word ethical in as much as possible. It's not sufficient from a Jewish ethical perspective to have a Beis Din system, to just set up a court and with shingles on in front that announces court of law, court of Jewish law, house of judgment, and put three people there and put hats on them and talisim over them and say, okay, you're going to be the judges, and not pay attention to the policies and procedures and protocols that are followed by that court to make sure they're doing things correctly, but rather there is an obligation of righteousness, righteousness, that you need an additional level of righteousness, holeich achar beis din yofeh, that you have to make sure that you have a beis din yofeh. You have to make sure you have a good, functional beis din that brings a credit to the judges and credit to the community in terms of the procedures that are followed. So that one of the responsibilities that a Jewish community has in terms of implementing this precept of Jewish law relating to both the prohibition against going to secular courts and the obligation of having a Beis Din is to make sure that there is a functional Beis Din that is capable of understanding the needs of the community that it serves, understanding the nature of the disputes, and understanding its capacity in terms of adjudicating those disputes. This is one of the reasons why the Beis Din of America in particular was established to consist not only of rabbis with halakhic expertise and who have impeccable ethical credentials, but also to have in its roster judges who are well-versed in the world of business and well-versed in the world of secular law, so that there can be an understanding and a comprehension of the various needs of the community and expectations of the community when they come before the Beis Din for the resolution of disputes. And in order to satisfy the second part of the requirement of setting up rabbinical courts, which is shoftim v'shoterim titen lecha, that you have to have judges and you also have to have enforcers of the law. So commentators point out what this means effectively is that, as the Medrash says, if you don't have a proper enforcement system, then you don't really have a proper judicial system. In order to have a viable judicial system, in accordance with Jewish law, there has to be the ability to enforce the judgments of the Beis Din. Therefore, the only way in which the judgments and the orders of the Beis Din can satisfy this standard of being enforceable in our contemporary community is if the judgments are in fact capable of enforcement by those who have enforcement power. Who has enforcement power in our community? The courts, the secular courts. So in this context where it is the secular courts that have the enforcement power, it is necessary for Beis Din to conduct its proceedings in such a way that they would be deemed enforceable by the secular courts. So in New York, the decisions of a Beis Din are deemed enforceable by secular courts, provided that the Beis Din functions as an arbitration tribunal subject to Article 75 of New York CPLR, which sets forth the procedural requirements of a court sitting in arbitration, of a tribunal that serves as an arbitration tribunal. And the same way that the decisions of the American Arbitration Association are enforceable, so too it is exactly in the same fashion that decisions of a Beis Din, whether the Beis Din of America or another Beis Din, are considered to be enforceable by virtue of complying with those requirements. What are those requirements? Those requirements are basically that the parties have to enter into a binding arbitration agreement, and you have in the materials in the table of contents, section 2, an arbitration agreement form, which basically has the names of the parties, a description of the dispute, and an explicit statement that the parties have accepted upon themselves a Beis Din to resolve their disputes and shall accept the ruling of the arbitrators as a binding decision. There is an acceptance of the parties in a binding fashion to accept the decision of the Beis Din, and there's also the opportunity for parties to put an arbitration clause in contracts that they enter into, in which they explicitly provide, as we have in the section 3, any controversy or claim shall be settled by arbitration by the Beis Din of America or whichever Beis Din the parties happen to choose. And this empowers a Beis Din to have the status under New York arbitration law of being able to render a decision that will be binding upon the parties as much and as if the parties had appeared before an actual court of law under the secular legal system. The Beis Din then has to render a written decision after hearing the case between the parties, and that decision can then be entered into judgment in any single court of competent jurisdiction. There are also procedural requirements For example, that a betdin must provide adequate time and notice to the parties before convening any proceeding. That, for example, the judges can't be biased in any fashion, that there can't be fraud or corruption in the rendering of the suit, that the parties have to have ample opportunity to present their cases. Basically, all requirements that are, in any event, consistent with the mandates of Jewish law. So what the Beit Din of America did was to formulate a series of rules and procedures that were published and circulated to the parties and then incorporated through the signing of the arbitration agreement, in which all of these requirements are spelled out and in which the Jewish law requirements of the arbitration are also incorporated into the rules and procedures, so that there is a comprehensive package presentable to the parties that can create a better understanding of the arbitration process and satisfy the requirements of Holech HaChavez Din Yafeh, hopefully create an environment where the parties are not only going to a Bezdin, but are going to a Bezdin which is careful and sensitive and accountable according to the requirements of Jewish law from a Jewish law perspective, and according to the requirements of secular law from an arbitration law perspective, so that the judgments can be capable of enforcement from the perspective of secular from the perspective of secular law as well. I note in the article that is in tab 4 of the table of contents that according to classical Jewish law, one could undertake an obligation to obligate themselves to follow a decision by a Bezdin in most respects by doing what's known as a kinyan sudar, which means that you lift up an object of value like a handkerchief or a pen, like a chassan would do at a chassan's tish, like a groom does when he gets married to undertake the applications of the ksubas. Anybody who sat in through a chassan's tish sees that at some point he picks up a pen and picks up a handkerchief. Nowadays, there are less handkerchiefs around. Used to be everybody had handkerchiefs, though few people walk around with handkerchiefs. But either a handkerchief or a sudar literally means handkerchief. So you could obligate yourself under Jewish law with the picking up of a handkerchief, but this would probably not pass muster according to Article 75 of the arbitration statute in terms of making the decision of the Beis Din binding. Therefore, as a matter of Jewish law, it becomes imperative not merely to rely upon somebody's picking up of a handkerchief, but actually to require the parties to sign an arbitration agreement. Now, this always presented a little bit of attention from the idealistic perspective of a former Cleary Gottlieb lawyer who had gone into the Beis Din industry for idealistic reasons, for purposes of bringing truth and justice to the Jewish way, which is supposed to be a way of truth and justice and, in fact, a beacon of light to the nations. And like some of you, I had heard stories of people being dissatisfied with the way in which Beit Din function, and always the best solution to such types of dissatisfaction is that instead of just complaining about the way things are done, since the Beis Din is a vital institution within the Jewish community, it's better to try at least to be a part of the solution. So really, from the perspective of people having fears and inhibitions and suspicions about the process, the worry that maybe there are biases towards a particular party, or whatever people were afraid about, I didn't conduct a thorough investigation of the Beis Din system to see whether any of these fears were true or founded, but what was crystal clear to me and to my colleagues was that it was absolutely essential that we try to create a Beis Din system that would certainly dispel any of such fears and any of such concerns. So from an idealistic perspective, the focus is really on the second half of the equation, the positive part, not the negative part about the prohibition of going to secular courts, which is true, it exists, and I would tell that to people, and I still tell that to you, because there is such a Jewish law in the books, and one has to be sensitive to it as a Jewish party, and also as a Jewish attorney, or as an attorney representing Jewish parties, that it's something which the parties may care about, and something which, at least within the Jewish community, could carry a certain amount of weight in affecting their decisions of where they want to adjudicate cases. But the second half of the equation, namely the negative part, the prohibition against going to secular courts, was not our sell per se. We weren't looking to attract people to come to Beis Din based on the prohibition. The prohibition exists. But our main sell was come to the Beis Din because the Beis Din is a wonderful institution, because we're going to do justice, because we have proper trained judges, because we're going to follow all of the procedures that are required by arbitration law, because we're sensitive to community standards, because we're sensitive to the customs of the marketplace, etc., etc. Nonetheless, part of the responsibility of the Beis Din is, in fact, to apply appropriate sanctions in cases where parties refuse to satisfy their Jewish law obligation of going in front of a Beis Din and violate the negative prohibition against going to the secular courts instead. So, probably one of the most difficult parts of working at the Beis Din is when it becomes necessary to penalize a party for their refusal to come before a Beis Din. But there is such a concept in Jewish law, and this is known as a siruv, where the halacha is, the Jewish law rule is, that if a party is summoned to Beis Din and they refuse to come to Beis Din, then the Beis Din issues a siruv, the Beis Din issues a contempt order against that party, basically announcing that the party has violated their obligation under Jewish law to come before a Beis Din, to come before the rabbinical court. And the siruv also accomplishes the purpose that since the parties are not otherwise permitted to go or have recourse to the secular courts under halacha, according to Jewish law, the siruv gives them explicit permission that in such a case, since they have no choice but to litigate their case in secular court because the other party refuses to come to Beis Din, so then in such a case they are given leave, they are given recourse to litigate their case in secular court. So actually, I suppose that from a secular lawyer perspective, a seiruv actually has a certain liberating effect, which is that it empowers a party who would otherwise have not gone to secular court because they wanted to go through the Beis Din system, wanted to comport with Jewish law. It empowers them under those circumstances to be able to go to secular court. So there have been certain cases which relate to claims of libel or defamation in connection with the issuance of a seiruv, because a seiruv appears to be a derogatory comment about somebody. And so this was the part of the job that I didn't like. I didn't like issuing derogatory comments about people, but it's viewed as, could be viewed by somebody as derogatory that they have failed to comply with Jewish law. So we always very circumspect, try to be, before issuing this type of document. And in fact, there are cases where parties brought suit in which they claim that they were liable by the issuance of a seiruv. So one of such cases is the case of, in tab 14, of Nyman Ginsburg v. Goldberg, which is a very interesting case, because this case also raises the issue of what the standards are by which a Beis Din adjudicates a case. In this particular case, there were two parties that had a dispute. They had a monetary dispute. Plaintiff summoned the defendant to a particular Beis Din, and the defendant said that I am willing to go to the Beis Din, but I'm only willing to go on one condition. And that is that the Beis Din decides the case according to strict principles of Jewish law. And you know what the Beis Din said? The Beis Din said, you're such a good Jew, you're too good. That in this modern era, and in the age in which we live, the truth is this was already codified hundreds of years ago by the Shulchan Aruch, no Beis Din can feel completely secure that it is the repository of complete mastery of all aspects of Jewish law. Therefore, the practice of Bate Din, the practice of rabbinical courts, is to mix together the notion of applying strict Jewish law with notions of equity, with notions of equitable considerations, the circumstances of the case. According to Jewish law, maybe you need two witnesses who qualify as valid witnesses according to Jewish law, which is a very limited field. And maybe here you didn't have the two witnesses, but there was a very strong preponderance of evidence that one party should be awarded a substantial amount. Or maybe under strict law, one party would receive 100%, but the Beis Din feels that for the sake of peace, we'll make it 90%, and we'll make a little bit of a pshara, we'll make a little bit of a compromise. So nowadays, a Beis Din, according to the law books of Jewish law, according to the code of Jewish law, is really supposed to mingle, ideally, considerations of halacha, considerations of, I should say, din, is a better word, considerations of pure Jewish law, with considerations of pshara, of equity, compromise type considerations as well. So the rabbinical court in this case said, we are not going to decide the case according to strict justice, because we don't feel that's an appropriate standard. We're rather going to decide it based on a mingling of law and equity, right? It used to be that the American courts, in the early years, right, that you had courts sitting in law and courts sitting in equity, right, and then it all got mixed together, that it's all law and equity bunched together. So it's the same concept. The courts are supposed to apply a combination of law and equity in the consideration of their decisions. And the defendant said, no, I will not go to Beis Din unless it is strict law. Famous Talmudic expression, Yikov Adina Sahar, that let the strict justice burn a hole through the mountain, that this is the only way that I am going to agree to submit to Beis Din. Beis Din said, that's not good enough. And therefore, they issued a siruv, a contempt order against the party, that the party had failed to comply with their Jewish law obligations. So the fellow came before the court and said, this is libelous. I only wanted to comply with my Jewish law obligation. I was prepared to come before the Beis Din and have the Beis Din decide the case according to strict principles of Jewish law. So the court basically said, don't be a wise guy. Okay? The Beis Din, I'm sure, understands Jewish law a lot better than we do, and whatever it is that you were supposed to do under Jewish law, and we are not going to usurp the Beis Din's ecclesiastical authority to make determinations of what constitutes a proper submission according to Jewish law. The Beis Din determined that whatever you were prepared to do was not a proper submission according to Jewish law. We're not going to revisit that determination, and therefore we're not going to decree this seruv as a libelous document harming your reputation. So this basically is the latitude which is given for a Beis Din to make ecclesiastical determinations. This is different from rendering an arbitration decision, because this is a case where there is no signed arbitration agreement by the parties. The Beis Din is basically issuing what is a non-binding ecclesiastical determination. It is simply giving instruction to one party that in its opinion it is allowed to pursue the case in the secular courts, which raises a separate question, which is, if we have determined that according to Jewish law a party is not allowed to go to the secular courts, and the party is required to appear before a Beis Din and not a civil court, so since when can a Beis Din just decide that it's going to give leave for somebody to commit a prohibition under Jewish law? Could a Beis Din, for example, issue a decree that a person is allowed to violate Shabbos? Could a Beis Din issue a decree that a person is allowed to eat milk and meat together? Certainly not. A Beis Din doesn't have that type of prerogative to override the rules that are given by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So what then would justify the Beis Din determination that the party is allowed to go to secular court? So here we have two different sources which would provide for the allowance in certain circumstances for a client, in fact, to go to civil court. One is the Mishnah, which I have in tab 7, which is the Mishnah in Gittin. The Mishnah in Gittin talks about a case of a get. Let's say that there is a dispute between a husband and wife as to whether the husband is obligated to give a get. Something never happens, right? That there's a divorce proceeding, and the wife says, I want a get, and the husband says, I don't want to give you a get. So, unfortunately, this is almost the bread and butter type case of Bate Din nowadays, dealing with these very difficult divorce situations where parties have a disagreement about either whether to give a get or when to give a get, and the Beis Din declares that the husband is obligated to give a get. Obligated even to the point that we would force him to give the get. So says the Mishnah, then in such a case, that if I have a decree from a Beis Din that a get needs to be given, then in such a case, that it is permissible basically to turn over the individual to the secular courts, and for the secular courts to beat the husband up and say, do what the Jewish court, do what the Beis Din required you to do. The Beis Din required you to give a get, so we are hereby enforcing the Beis Din's decision that you have to give a get. So what this basically says is that there are cases where a Beis Din has the prerogative to refer a party to the secular court when the Beis Din is not capable of enforcing its judgment directly. So that is one source. This is the source that would primarily justify the case where a Beis Din has issued a decision, and the Beis Din then, if it is lacking enforcement power of its own, allows a party to go to the secular court for enforcement of the decision of the Beis Din, because Beis Din has already rendered a decision. This is not considered to be problematic. Why? Because it's not the secular court that is adjudicating the case or is deciding what is right or wrong, or what is the appropriate legal standard. It's a secular court basically serving as an agent of the rabbinical court, as an agent of the Beis Din, in order to enforce the Beis Din's decree. What about the case where the person refuses to show up altogether in front of the Beis Din? So this is source number 8, which is the excerpt from the Gemara, the Babylonian Talmud, Bava Kamma, 92b, Tzadik Beis Amud Beis. In the underlined version, I'll read and translate, the Gemara doesn't seem to have anything whatsoever to do with secular courts and Bate Din, but you have to apparently read between the lines. Amale Rava L'Rabba Bamari, Rava asked Rava Bamari, Minaha Milsa, where do we find a basis for the folk expression? To Ami Inchi, there's a folk expression, Karis Chavach Vloanach. If you call your friend and he doesn't answer, Rami Guda Rabba Shadi Bey. So take a brick wall and throw it on him. So that sounds rather severe. So what is he talking about? So the Gemara gives a verse that seems to substantiate this practice. So the commentator, the Rosh, in section 9, comments on this Gemara, that what the Gemara is really talking about is, what does it mean you're calling your friend and he doesn't answer? It means you're calling your friend, you're summoning somebody to a Din Torah. You go in front of the Beis Din, and you summon the person to a Din Torah. What does this mean practically speaking? A Beis Din can send a Hazmana. A Beis Din, basically, just like a court sends a summons, a Beis Din sends a summons. The way that it typically works is that the attorney goes in front of the Beis Din, or the party himself or herself goes in front of the Beis Din and says, I would like to file a claim against another party. And the Beis Din says, good, please give us your name and the name of the other party and the nature of your claim. At the Beis Din of America, we ask for backup documentation as well in order to weed out any spurious claims. And then, when the paperwork is filed, the Beis Din will send a summons. According to the Gemara, Bezin sends up to 3 summonses. Why is that? Based on a recognition that maybe somebody's away, they didn't get the first summons. Maybe they're not paying close attention. They didn't pay attention to the first 2 summonses. But if they've received 3 summonses already, and they have not responded to any of the summonses, they have not agreed to come to Bezin, maybe they've responded. They've said, thank you very much, and go take a hike. I'm not coming to Bezin. So either they haven't responded at all, or they've responded that they refuse to come to Beis Din. They have the right to say, as it's spelled out in our rules and procedures, they have the right to say, we'll go to a different Beis Din. But let's say they haven't agreed to go to any Beis Din at all. So then the Gemara is construed by the Rosh basically as meaning that in such a case you can throw the book at him. You can throw the book at the party that refuses to come to Beis Din. Says the Rosh, Mikam Pasuk Rapaltaizal, one of the Gaonim, concluded from this Gemara, Ruvain Sheshul Tfiyah al Shimon, the proverbial Ruvain and Shimon. Ruvain has a claim on Shimon, a Masarv Lava Ladin, and Shimon refuses to come to the Beis Din, Shirashai Labil Arko Shanachim Gedelahotzi Shlomi Tachas Yodo. That he is allowed then to go to the secular courts in order to recover from his claim. Now, there's a big difference, the commentators explain, between whether you're deriving the right to go to the secular courts based on the first source, which says, do what the Jewish courts tell you you have a right to do. That's the case of the get. And the second source is, which says, you call someone to come to Beis Din, they refuse to go, so then throw the book at him. Throw the wall at him, literally, but throw the book at him. What's the difference between, practically speaking, between these two sources? So the difference is, what about a case where according to Jewish law, according to the Bat Din, Ruvain would not be able to recover from Shimon, and would only be able to recover $100 from Shimon. And according to the secular courts, Ruvain would be able to recover $1,000 from Shimon. So strictly speaking, having a Beis Din system is both a system that we should have a Jewish judicial system of courts and judges within our own community to demonstrate that the Torah law is capable of handling monetary issues within our community, but it also stands for the proposition that the substantive rules of Torah law, of Jewish law, are the rules that should be followed by our community, by the Jewish community, by the Jewish community in terms of resolving disputes. So if one would have a claim in which they would not be able to recover under Jewish law, or be able only to recover less under Jewish law, then strictly speaking, from a Jewish law perspective, they have no right to go to the secular courts and recover more. So if the only right that one would ever have to go to secular court would be to enforce that which a Beis Din would rule, then it would follow that even when we give leave to somebody to go to secular court, they're not allowed to collect more than what a Beis Din would have awarded them. And in fact, that is the opinion of the famous commentator on Chol Shem Mishpat, Nesivos HaMishpat. On the other hand, if the source that we're relying upon in allowing a person to go to secular court is the source from the Gemara in Baba Kama, then when you call somebody and he refuses to come to Beis Din, you have the right to throw the book at him. So why such strong language? Maybe that's the way, rabbis talk, right? Yeah, throw the wall in. So, but why such strong language? So we assume there's a reason for such strong language. The reason why the language is so strong is because it's almost like a penalty. This person refuses to avail himself of the Beis Din system, and therefore, by that refusal, that person has subjected themselves to the legal system of the secular courts, even if that means that they're going to end up losing a lot more money than they would have ended up losing in the Beis Din. And in fact, the custom, it has been pointed out by many recent commentators, the custom of Bat Din is not to circumscribe the right of a party to go to secular court when the other party refuses to go to Beis Din, to only collect the amount that it would be determined they would have the right to collect in Beis Din, but to allow them to collect a larger, to whatever amount they will end up collecting according to the secular court system. Now this is all very simple from a legal practitioner's perspective, if one is representing a client, and that client wants to go to Beis Din, so they saw you, or they want to follow the dictates of Jewish law, so you find a proper Beis Din, whatever you define as a Beis Din Yafe, and you summon the other party to appear before a proper Beis Din. If the party agrees, so then you go through the Beis Din process. If the party doesn't agree, so then you have the right to go to a secular court. Once the Beis Din issues the edict, the one is allowed to go to secular court. What about in the flip case, where you are representing the defendant? What if you're representing a defendant and the plaintiff wants to go either to Beis Din or to secular court? So if the plaintiff wants to go to Beis Din, so that's easy. You might just have some wrangling about which Beis Din to go to. I mean, I make that sound simple. Sometimes the wrangling can be very substantial if you have a real problem with the Beis Din that was selected by the plaintiff, and you want to go to a different Beis Din. So then the rule is that in a community where there is no established Beis Din, and in New York City, there's no single Beis Din that is the official established Beis Din of the entire community, much as we try to create some sort of official Beis Din network, there are multiple Batei Din. So if both parties agree on a Beis Din, then it's very simple. If they don't agree on a Beis Din, then what typically happens is that the two parties have to either find a mutually agreeable Beis Din, but if they're not capable of finding a mutually agreeable Beis Din, I think I have this summarized in the piece in the... I wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal. That's tab number 5. Basically, the background of this piece was that there was some publicity in the newspapers at the time regarding who was going to become the successor of the late Satmar Rebbe in terms of being the Grand Rebbe of the Satmar movement. And there was a tremendous fascination in the general community over watching sort of a public spectacle of an issue within the Jewish community playing itself out, and they wanted a Jewish legal perspective from a Beis Din perspective of how these types of disputes would typically be handled. So I was sort of ginger in writing an article because I didn't feel comfortable speaking about details of any specific dispute, but I took it as an opportunity to discuss the general procedures of how the Beis Din system works, particularly in terms of getting a case in Beis Din as well. So if you look at the last paragraph on the left column of the piece, I ask the question, but which Beis Din? There is no single institutional rabbinical court that serves the entire Jewish community in America. In New York, there are at least a dozen such courts. If Shimon and Reuven cannot agree on its Beis Din, they can request an ad hoc rabbinical court comprised of 3 rabbis. What's an ad hoc rabbinical court? So this is a term that you should familiarize yourselves with because it's part of the general parlance of the Beis Din world, and that is a zabla. An ad hoc rabbinical tribunal is known as a zabla. It's an acronym for Zeb Borer Lo Echa. This one chooses one. It's kind of, you know, like a gunslinging match. This one chooses one gunslinger, the other one chooses another gunslinger, and the two of them pick a third dayan, right? One selected by each side, and a third selected by the first two. So much of the difficulty in the world of Beis Din adjudication is when parties can agree upon a Beis Din, and then it becomes a zabla situation, because there, according to strict principles of Jewish law, even when a judge is selected by one side, they're supposed to be completely impartial. And they're supposed to have the potential of ruling even against the side that has selected them. But sometimes in Zabla proceedings, there's a tendency of parties to want to pick an individual whom they feel is going to be favorable towards them, and there's also more of a potential in this type of context for the violation against the rule of ex parte communications between parties and their judges as well. So here, what is ideal, according to Jewish law, is that if, for example, one party wants to go to Beis Din A, and the other party wants to go to Beis Din B, rather than having the parties just choose advocates, essentially, as the judges of their choice, and then those two advocates will pick one impartial judge, which, by the way, from what I understand, is the way that it often works in these types of arrangements in general arbitration. But Jewish law actually is very strict concerning ensuring a greater degree of impartiality. So what is generally recommended is that instead of the parties choosing kind of their own personal advocate, Beis Din A should designate one impartial dayan, Beis Din B should then designate one impartial dayan, and those two dayanim, those two judges, should then pick an impartial dayan, an impartial judge from Beis Din C. And in fact, there were a number of cases in which we went about the adjudication in that fashion. But we would generally take the position that in the event that a judge who was selected was clearly serving as an advocate for the party that selected that judge, that the other party would have the right to refuse to participate in that type of Beis Din. And in that type of setting, we would generally take the position that while we could not hold a party in contempt for agreeing to submit to a Zabla proceeding and picking someone who's an advocate, because there are some who might countenance such a practice, but we would not compel the other party to submit to such a proceeding either, and would generally give permission to pursue the case in secular courts under such circumstances, whether the party was the defendant or whether the party was the plaintiff. But let's say that it ends up where the plaintiff does not even agree to submit to some sort of Zabla mechanism, whether it's a proper or improper Zabla process, but the plaintiff says, I am suing defendant in secular court. So is the defendant under those circumstances permitted to go to secular court without permission of the Beis Din? So the answer is yes. That if somebody is taken to secular court, you don't need a clearer manifestation of a plaintiff's intent not to go to Beis Din than the fact that the plaintiff has taken you to secular court. That makes it crystal clear the plaintiff's not going to Beis Din, they're going to secular court. Ideally, under those circumstances, it is still proper for the defendant to summon the plaintiff to take the case out of secular courts and into Beis Din, but the defendant does have the right under those circumstances to defend themselves in a secular court. But let's say then that the defendant defends themselves in secular courts, and the case drags on for about a year or so, and they spend $100,000 in court fees, and finally it comes to the end of the process, and they don't like the decision at the end. So normally, the Ramah rules that if a plaintiff takes a defendant to secular court, and then they lose the case, and then after they lose the case, they have this unbelievable, like, born-again Jewish experience in which they recognize that they were a sinner all their life, and how could they have done such a terrible thing to go to secular courts, and they want to redeem their ways, and the first act of repentance is that they say, I want to re-adjudicate that case that I wrongly brought to secular court. It just so happens that I lost the case as well, but I am inspired to do the right thing now, and now I want to adjudicate the case in Beis Din. So the Ramah says, tough luck, you get one bite at the apple, you went to secular court, you lost, you don't get to come to Beis Din. What about the defendant? Can the defendant, who went through this year of litigating the case in secular courts, now at the end of the process, come to Beis Din and say, hey, you know what, I lost the case in secular court, but I'm not the one who brought it to secular court. So can the defendant then come back to Beis Din? So if you look in source number 11, a very instructive source from the She'arim Mesuyonim Bahalacha, which is a later day commentary on the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, so it says the She'arim Mesuyonim Bahalacha, he quotes the Maharsham, that if the Nitba, the defendant, litigated the entire case in secular court, never sought to remove the case from secular court into Beis Din, even though they were perfectly within their rights to do so, because they're not the ones who brought it to secular court, but still, once they went through the entire process, they didn't do anything wrong, mind you. They didn't do anything wrong at all, but the fact that they have been, that they were willing, without challenging it, to pursue the entire case in secular court, presumably including their defenses and even, you know, whatever counterclaims may have been brought, they then forfeit their ability at the end of this process to come back to Beis Din and say, oh, since I lost, now I want to relitigate everything in Beis Din for all the losses that I for all the losses that I incurred. The Abba Zuchuso, and the defendant in such a case would lose their ability as well. Not because we are impugning in any way the defendant, but because we're recognizing the reality of how these cases work, that once one has completely invested themselves into the case, then they are essentially accepting upon themselves that jurisdiction, and indeed, if they would emerge victorious, they would not then seek to relitigate the case in Beis Din, just to make sure that the secular court got it right. So just like they're not going to relitigate the case if they emerge victorious, we don't, according to the Maharsham, allow them to relitigate the case in the event that they did not emerge victorious. Now, there's a separate question of, is there any kind of middle ground? Is there any kind of mechanism which is neither Beis Din nor secular court that would be okay from a Jewish law perspective? Meaning, the prohibition against going to the secular courts, do we say that that prohibition, as long as it is not violated, then the parties have satisfied their Jewish law obligation? Or do we say that there is an absolute affirmative need that not only must you not go to secular court, but you must go to a Beis Din institution? What do I mean by this? Let's say that parties agree that they're going to resolve their dispute through some third-party arbitration that's not a Beis Din. Let's say they agree that they're going to go to the American Arbitration Association, or let's say they agree that they're in the securities world, and they agree that they will arbitrate before a neutral panel of security experts, or they're in the architecture industry, and they agree that they are going to arbitrate their dispute before the American Association Board of Architects, or whatever it's called, which is, I believe, a standard clause in an architectural contract, to go before that type of trade arbitration panel. Are you allowed to engage, according to Jewish law, in that type of dispute resolution? So, says Rabbi Akiva Eger, we're quoted by the Piskei Tshuva quotes this, that's the source number 12, that if you have a community of merchants, an industry community in which every member of that industry or every member of that community arbitrates their disputes before an arbitration panel of industry experts, then that is not considered to be a violation of the prohibition against going to secular courts. And in fact, in such a case, if this is the practice of everybody within a certain industry, then you have no right to require that the party comes to Beis Din. If a party summoned to Beis Din say, no, I insist on following the practice of this industry and going in front of the secular, it's not secular, going in front of the arbitration panel of the industry experts, even though it's not a Beis Din, that they have the right to insist that this is the way that the dispute be resolved. And the reason for this is because we're not necessarily looking to proliferate more litigation per se. let's say Reuven and Shimon have a dispute, and somehow they are able to flout the system altogether by sneakily resolving their dispute between themselves without any lawyers and without any judges, and they just kind of like meet and say, oh, you owe me money. No, I don't owe you money. And then they speak about it for 5 minutes and they resolve it between themselves. Do you think they're allowed to do so? So the answer is sure. Not only are they allowed to do so, but they're encouraged to do so. Gadol HaShalom, we like peace. We want people to be able to resolve disputes by themselves. So therefore, if they find some other mechanism to be able to resolve their dispute, even though they haven't officially gone to Beis Din, as long as they haven't violated the transgression of presenting the case before the secular court, so that would be okay from a Jewish law perspective. So if parties insert into their contract that if there's a dispute between the architect and the homeowner, that it will be presented before the board of architectural arbitrators, this would be considered to be perfectly acceptable from the perspective of Torah law, from the perspective of Jewish law, provided, there's one proviso which is mentioned by the Shach and others, provided that the arbitrators have the flexibility of not being bound by secular statutes, where they're not essentially viewed as emissaries or extensions of the secular court system, but they have the flexibility not to be to be able to decide in accordance with general principles of fairness and justice and industry custom, so then it's not considered to be an extension of the secular court system. Now, one corollary of this discussion is that parties cannot actually contract to have, according to Jewish law, to have their disputes adjudicated by a secular court. What do I mean by that? That sometimes we have a principle in Jewish law that even though something is not generally the de facto Jewish law rule, parties are allowed to contract around it. If I am guarding property of yours and I'm not getting paid for it, so I'm not generally obligated if the property gets stolen, but I can independently say I'm going to obligate myself. Or if I'm guarding property and I am getting paid, I'm a shomer sachar, then I am obligated to pay you if the object gets stolen, but we can contract between ourselves that I'm not going to be obligated because the two of us agree to it and we can make conditions in the monetary sphere. So you might think that parties could then also contract in the monetary sphere that they agree, that the two of them agree that they're going to decide their disputes in secular courts. However, here, all of the commentators pretty much say that this is not considered to be an issue of monetary law, but it's considered to be an issue of ritual law. Just like you can't contract to violate Shabbos, so too you can't contract to go to the secular courts. What's a much more robust area of discussion is whether you're allowed to contract that you will go to Beis Din, and the Beis Din, the Jewish rabbinical court, will decide the dispute, but they will decide the dispute according to principles of secular law. Let's say according to principles of New York law. And here you have a real dispute and discussion among different Jewish law authorities about whether this is also considered to be an extension of the prohibition of going to secular courts, because as Rashi said, the problem is that you're giving credence to a different legal system, so here too you're giving credence to a different legal system, or whether we say no, that parties are allowed to make conditions in monetary matters. It's a private condition that these parties are making. Ultimately, they're accepting the Torah system because they're willing to go to Beis Din. They're willing to go to the rabbinical court and to let the rabbinical court decide the degree to which their contractual provision is enforceable from the standpoint of Jewish law. So at least the Beis Din of America, if you look at tab 17, which is the famous arbitration agreement, sometimes referred to as prenuptial agreement, signed by prospective grooms and wives when they get married. And this is an agreement, I think, that has become much more widespread, that there are some rabbis who really don't even perform weddings unless the party signed this agreement. This is an agreement that provides protection in the event that there would be a dispute about a get, and you'd have, for example, a husband who would want to hold up a get and not give it to his his wife upon a divorce. So here the parties have bound themselves to appear before the Beis Din to follow whatever decision the Beis Din issues with respect to the get, and it also gives teeth to the Beis Din to impose monetary payments upon the husband as a support obligation for every day in which the get is not given. So there's a section here, if you look at page 1 of this agreement, the big rectangular section, which says sections 4A and 4B are optional, in which the Beis Din gives the option to the parties to submit not only the get dispute to the Beis Din, but also any monetary disputes to the Beis Din, meaning disputes relating to equitable distribution or child support or spousal support, that those issues could be presented to the Beis Din as well. But the Beis Din recognizes, and this is, I think, part of what I consider to be a Beis Din Yafeh type analysis, having a full-service Beis Din for the community, recognizes that there are certainly many members of the community that expect that with respect to certain monetary dealings that they have, and particularly with respect to the distribution of assets and rights upon the dissolution of a marriage, that the scheme that would be followed would be consistent with the normal scheme of secular society in which we live, in which there are certain expectations as to how things get divided up. And in New York, that scheme is typically referred to as equitable distribution. So the agreement actually gives affords the parties the opportunity to explicitly empower the Beis Din. You look at 4A2, the parties agree the Beis Din is authorized to decide any monetary disputes, including division of property and maintenance, that may arise between them based on principles of equitable distribution law customarily employed in the United States. And the idea here, the premise is that parties have the right to engage in a private arrangement of what their monetary terms will be so long as they accept upon themselves the authority of the Beis Din. They are, after all, going to the Beis Din with respect to how to adjudicate the get issue. They're not completely abrogating Torah law in any way. And they're also premising this acceptance upon following that which is customarily employed, in which they're making it clear that they're not looking to reject the Torah system of law, but they are simply following the age-old Jewish custom of following local custom. That there is a notion of minhag hasochrim, of following local custom. It's for the same reason Rabbi Akiva Eger ruled that trade merchants can insist that their issues be resolved in front of an arbitration board of trade merchants. By the same principle, parties can insist that they want their marriage monetary disputes to be decided in accordance with general principles of equitable distribution law. You had a question? Okay, so I'm just going to, since I see the hour is concluding, I will just conclude with one last thought from the last tab of tab 18, and that is that one has to be mindful, and this is something which the Beis Din needs to be mindful as well, of limitations of enforceability. Which is that a Beis Din's enforcement power derives primarily from the ability of the Beis Din's decisions to be enforceable in courts of law based on following procedural requirements of Article 75. But there are some areas of arbitration which fit into the category of what we call the public policy exception of arbitration law, meaning that there are certain areas of adjudication where the courts have decided that as a matter of public policy, the courts do not wish to empower any arbitration tribunal, whether it's a Beis Din or whether it is a secular arbitration panel, to have the ability to have the ultimate word with respect to certain issues. And the classical area of that principle is in terms of parenting rights, in terms of custody and visitation, in the context of a divorce, where parties sometimes do present custody and visitation determinations to the Beis Din. In my years at the Beis Din, we probably, you know, had around a dozen cases in which we dealt with custody and visitation issues. But ultimately, that type of arbitration process, in order to be effective, has to be what's known as a collaborative arbitration process, which means where the courts, in this particular context, will generally not, according to almost every case that's been decided in New York, I don't think it's come up to the Court of Appeals, but pretty much every single case that's been decided in the court of the courts of New York over the last 15 years or so, the courts have consistently held that custody and visitation disputes are not subject to enforceable arbitration, and if one party is dissatisfied with the decision of the arbitrators, they can renew the litigation or restart the litigation in civil courts, and the decision would not be enforceable against that party if they do not consent in it. So the arbitration process takes the form of collaborative arbitration, means where there's an arbitration process in which the parties essentially collaborate with each other, where there's an agreement, a good faith agreement between the parties and their attorneys, that assuming that there is a proper process that's followed by the Beis Din, meaning the Beis Din uses appropriate experts and focuses on best interests of the children and so forth, that everybody agrees that they trust the process of the Beis Din enough that they will accept the Beis Din's decision. It's almost like a mediation process where people agree to arrive at an agreement at the end of the day, and here they're just using the Beis Din to facilitate that agreement since they can't do it on their own, but ultimately they agree that they will accept the Beis Din decision at the end of the day. My experience has been, interestingly enough, that even though there is this public policy exception with respect to custody and visitation, in all such cases that have come to the Beis Din has been able to dispose of these issues in a way that was satisfactory enough to the parties that they incorporated the Beis Din's decision into a settlement agreement, which is something which is held to be enforceable, although subject to review if challenged, but nonetheless presumptively enforceable, so that even in those areas, it is possible to guide a client through the Beis Din process, but just with an awareness that there is limited enforceability. And there are other areas, such as child support, where a Beis Din can adjudicate, as the case Hirsch v. Hirsch points out, but where a Beis Din is duty-bound to follow the secular principles of child support determinations as set forth in the Child Support Standards Act, the CSSA. So a Beis Din in its decision has to be careful to illustrate how it has followed the various guidelines of the CSSA and justify any departure from those guidelines. It's interesting in the case in the materials, although there's often a concern that a Beis Din in divorce cases in particular will find more heavily in favor of the husband. In this case, the court actually chastised the Beis Din that it awarded a child support amount against the husband in excess of that which the court felt was appropriate under the circumstances. However, it could be in certain circumstances that a greater amount is warranted, but a Beis Din has to be careful, and lawyers participating in the process have to be careful that a Beis Din knows what it's doing to make sure to explain in its decision in a reasoned fashion any possible departure from the CSSA. So this is basically a very cursory and very preliminary summary of some of the issues relating to, from a Jewish law perspective, the requirement to litigate disputes in a Beis Din and not in secular courts, some of the circumstances in which a Beis Din would give a leave to allow for adjudication in secular courts, such as when one party refuses to come to Beis Din or for purposes of enforcing a Beis Din decision, and analysis of the various problems that could arise when there has not been a pre-agreed upon Beis Din forum for adjudication of disputes, and parties cannot agree on a particular Beis Din, what the respective obligations of plaintiffs and defendants are in these types of cases, and the various parameters of what happens when a Beis Din issues a Seiruv, and the general court approach to the Seiruv is viewed as being an ecclesiastical determination and therefore subject to the discretion, the reasonable discretion of a Beis Din in individual cases. I would refer you to some of the language in the case cited in Article 15 regarding the general positive attitude that the courts have displayed for Beis Din arbitration in general in this country. We should certainly demonstrate or do our best to demonstrate to the courts that their confidence in the Beis Din system is properly placed before us, and thereby discharge our obligation of being a beacon of light to the nations of the world in terms of our justice system.